This is session number 2301, and the session title is The Effects of Artificial Intelligence on Business and Labor. Before I introduce the panel, just some real quick information about how to ask questions. If you have the app, please go ahead and ask your questions on the app, and they will show up on the computer in front of me here. If you are a student, please identify yourself as a student. It means you're special and you get priority with the questions. And then if you don't have the app, please flag down any of the volunteers who are here. They have note cards. You can write your question on a note card and send it in. And I believe this is one of the panels that's being live streamed around the world. So if you have a question and you're not in the room, again, please go ahead and just use the app to ask your question. And if you could identify where you're from, that would be awesome too. So we can go ahead and get started. At the far end down here is David Seuss. He is the CEO of Northern Lights, which is a knowledge management system. Next to him is Barrett Anderson. She is CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout AI, which is a media company exploring future technology. And next to me is Moses Ma. He is an innovation consultant and managing partner at Future Lab Consulting. And each of them has longer bios, again, on the app or in your little information packet, so you can learn more about them there. And we're going to just go ahead and get started. We'll start with them speaking for 5 minutes about what they expect the future of AI and jobs to look like, and then we will dive right into audience questions. So please start sending your questions as soon as you have them. And we will start, David, with you.
Okay, let's go. Is this good audio quality? Is my voice good? Okay, everybody can hear it? Good. All right, I'm tempted to do the old joke. Raise your hand if you can't hear me. Okay, so let me start with a bias. I don't think artificial intelligence exists, and it is certainly artificial, the state of the art, and there's nothing remotely intelligent about it. Practitioners in the field universally prefer the term machine learning to artificial intelligence. AI, the phrase comes from science fiction. It's like teleporters and faster than light travel. It is a marketing idea. Companies think if they sell you that their products use AI, you'll buy more of them. So they use it. Microsoft just has a marketing campaign going on right now called Microsoft AI. That was not decided upon by the highly talented machine learning engineers that work at Microsoft. I assure you that. It was the marketing people who came up with that phrase. And machine learning is different in that, first of all, it has the word machine, and secondly, the word learning. You can't learn something that someone else doesn't know. What the machines are really good at is learning what we know. And they're good at learning it from a large number of us at once, which is really the distinction between machine learning and human learning. Human learning is one-on-one. A machine can learn what a million people know. And that's the key difference. The machines are incapable of creating new information. There were 100,000 articles written last year in peer-reviewed journal articles for life sciences, all by human beings. Not one was written by a machine. What the machines are terrific at is summarizing what people know about a topic, and the information that has been generated by human beings. Now that brings us then to talk about what is the impact on the job market. First of all, it's not about automation. It's not about eliminating customer service jobs and all the things you read in the uninformed press about the future of AI. That's just automation like has been going on for centuries, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Machines replace people at tedious, repetitive jobs. It always leads to an economic boom and more jobs available for everybody. So let's hope that happens quickly. But that's an absolutely trivial idea about where machine learning will impact the future. What machine learning really does is it helps human beings make better decisions. It brings more information into the process, synthesized information into the process, relevant, pithy, important information into the process, and it casts this wide net. What do all the scientists know about this question, not just one? So the profound impact of AI will be thousands and thousands of better decisions, each one of which is small, but which cumulatively will make a huge difference. You haven't read about AI finding the cure for cancer. $1 billion has been spent on that effort with no results. On the other hand, there are 1,000 research teams today working on finding a cure for cancer, all of which are supported by smart machines in a variety of different ways. And they're making more rapid and profound progress because of the contribution of the machines. So one of the first impacts is going to be of machine learning is going to be making R&D wildly more productive. So what's the impact then on the labor market? First of all, mechanical devices, computers, technology always separates the talented from the not talented. It makes the gap bigger. If I take a person talented in math and a person not talented in math and I give them a mechanical calculator, the difference in their math skills will be exaggerated. And that happens with machine learning too. The people who are and the organizations that are skilled at using the technologies will gain an advantage over those who doesn't. But for the people who aren't talented, who can't think about matrix algebra or a computer graph on an article to see what the important ideas are or whatever, machine learning is still a tremendous boon because it will lead to a great deal of economic expansion. Search was traditionally the application that used the most intensive CPU cycles. That's why Google owns a million servers. Search, the index of a document, the search index is larger than the document. When you index a document, it should create new information. But machine learning requires 5 times the CPU cycles that search indexing does. Think of the impact on the economy when we need 5 times more computers, 5 times more data centers, 5 times more people who install and support the equipment, 5 times more people who transport the parts, 5 times more people who build houses and apartments for those people who are building those computers and using them, 5 times more teachers for the kids that they will have, and the whole thing. Machine learning will drive a tremendous boom in the labor market. Jobs up and down, the skill set will be in demand. So in conclusion, I believe that the future belongs to companies, organizations, and people who can make the most effective use of the machines. And it's going to create a tremendous shortage of both skilled and unskilled labor in our economy.
So very quickly, before we move on to Barrett, it occurred to me that I forgot to introduce myself. I am Arielle Kahn. I am your moderator today. I work for an organization called the Future of Life Institute, and we deal a lot with artificial intelligence and working with AI researchers around the world to try to make sure we can design it so that it's safe for and beneficial for people. Now we can.
It's great to meet you, Arielle.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be here today. I agree with 2 things that you said.
Okay.
The first is I think that the impact of artificial intelligence and its ability is vastly overestimated, right? Artificial intelligence is not good at doing any kind of critical thinking or complex tasks. It's not necessarily even that good yet at doing manual repetitive tasks. Those are, you know, and it's important when we talk about this to understand that it is basically impossible to separate automation and artificial intelligence when you're talking about jobs loss, because they reinforce one another and are used together so frequently. The other thing I agree agree with is that the future belongs to the companies, organizations, and people who own artificial intelligence and are leading in that field. I think that's absolutely correct. The things that I don't agree with are the number of jobs that will be affected. So right now in the United States, truck driving is the number one job in 29 states. It's the number one full-time job for adults in 29 states. Those jobs are going away, right? They're early kind of initial. There's a wide range of, you mentioned of journalists, but a lot of think tanks and academics have studied this problem and tried to figure out what will this look like in the next few years. McKinsey estimates 400 to 800 million jobs lost worldwide by 2030. Thomas Frey estimates 2 billion lost worldwide by 2030. And so I think the thing that we have to realize is that this is actually very different. What we're looking at now is very different from the Industrial Revolution, which is it's often compared to, because of two factors. One is that there are far fewer companies now in the world than there were before. We're trending towards monopolies worldwide, right? And so, yes, there are upstarts and companies coming up, but it's becoming harder and harder and harder to compete against those companies. And the second is that because of artificial intelligence and automation, those companies are becoming much more efficient, right? And so when you are that company, you need a lot fewer humans to do the jobs that they used to do. And that's true not just across, you know, in truck driving and driving. Think about how many Uber drivers there are out there. Think about the service industry is going to be very hard hit, right? We will no longer need, for example, grocery store cashiers at the same level as we once did. We might need a couple to kind of like oversee things, but those numbers are going to go way down. I don't necessarily see waitstaff being replaced in the very near future because I think they are much more kind of like people focused, but they are being replaced in some places, right? And across grocery stores. Let's see what else. We've got entry-level legal jobs are being replaced pretty universally because most of what you do as an entry-level legal professional can be done by machines at this point. Delivery drivers. And then the things that we're going to have to deal with is as we're thinking about this shift, we're also dealing with another shift which is happening worldwide, which is because of this coalition and gathering of resources to a few companies that are really leading the field, we're also suffering from extreme income inequality, right? And that problem is only going to get worse the more that artificial intelligence is developed and goes forward. So I think what we really need to do to deal with this problem is we need to be investing massively in job retraining, right? So all of these people, truck drivers do not come out of their truck driving career and suddenly know how to be artificial intelligence developers, right? They do not come out of their truck driving career and suddenly understand, you know, how to switch to a different job that now is useful, right? They don't. So there's going to need to be a massive job retraining effort across the United States, around the world. And that's kind of my overall perspective. I think we are still a very, very, very long way from artificial intelligence being able to take over, you know, or do any kind of critical thinking. And we actually don't, you know, we were at the point now where most artificial intelligence developers or machine learning developers themselves, you know, don't fully understand the algorithms that they're building. So that's another aspect of it, right? There was an incident, I think it was this last year, but maybe, yeah, it was this last year at Google, where they plugged in two machine learning systems to each other to try and translate between each other, and they started speaking an entirely different language, and they had to unplug the machines, right? So they're not. We don't really, as humans, understand what we're doing, and that is another aspect just to consider as we move forward. That being said, there will also be job gains from artificial intelligence, absolutely. And there are things that will be really beneficial to bring artificial intelligence to bear on, right? So we can analyze huge sets of data. We can identify where poaching is taking place, right? We can identify climate areas that are in risk. We can identify species that are in risk. We can, you know, if you're trying to figure out if you're making bets on futures, right, you can see how many cars are in a Walmart parking lot, Walmart parking lots around the United States, using satellite data and artificial intelligence, and translate that across, you know, what you think their profits will be before they've announced them. So those kinds of things, there are a lot of huge opportunities that come as a result, but it will be a very painful transition, I believe.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Moses. I come from Silicon Valley, so take me to your leader. So I'm going to start by, I noticed that people just talk here, and I wanted to have you immerse in some of the interactivity that goes on. So I'd like you to shake the hand of someone in a row in front of you or behind you, so you can experience some social networking. In the row up front, not just next to you. Trade some cards. If you're students, go ahead and hook up for the evening if you're students. Okay, that's enough of that. All right. So the next one is I want you to stretch a little, and that's mobility. Go ahead, stretch a little. Yeah, okay. I wish I had a photo of this. Wait, I can't. Hold on just for a second. Okay, I'm going to take a photo of you. This takes way too long. If a UFO ever showed up, I would be, like, doing this. Okay, so everybody hold your hands and say, yes! Okay, I'm going to shoot a video. Everybody scream. Okay, and then the third one is I want you all to bring out your phones. And I encourage you to try to text while I talk, because that's the way I tell if I'm boring. Okay, so the basic idea there is that most corporations, they say, don't take out your phone, be polite. We say take out your phone, because we're not afraid of this. Right? We're not afraid of the future. We want to beat the future. So I just told a very large company what I felt about the future. And I said that you can't just look at artificial intelligence. You can't just look at blockchains. And you can't just look at quantum computing. All three are storms that are about to combine into a perfect storm. Over the next 3 to 7 years, these will hit. And the tsunami of change it will cause will be unlike anything you've ever experienced. Fate has been kind to us to give us Moore's Law, which doubles a computer every 18 months. And although it looks like it's incredibly breakneck speed for most people, that is nice continuous change for 20 years that we could get used to. The next shift is a computer that runs 100 million times faster than a normal computer. Google bought a quantum computer 3 years ago, tested it for Google Maps, and one quantum computer beat 1.2 million computers at Google at the exact same hard NP-complete problem. So they beat it by a factor of 100. It's 100 million times faster. To give you an idea of what you could do with this much power, we're working with a large special effects company. So it usually takes like 20 hours to render one frame of a film. Think of that happening in 1 second. Okay, that'll change VR to be much more real. We're working with a global logistics company. Think of never missing a package for Christmas ever. Okay, ever. That's the kind of reaction you get. So what I tell them that if a perfect storm is coming, you as a leader of your company should do one of two things. Either head to port because you're too scared, or what's better is to chart the storm, ride its edge to slingshot past your competition. And that's what I recommend. Now, people look at the first thing, when I talk about quantum computing, the first thing they say is, oh my God, isn't that going to break all the encryption? It's going to cost me a lot of money. It's a lot of trouble. And that's like, you know, people texting during my talk, right? I'm not afraid of that because it's not that big an issue. Yeah, an ounce of prevention there to put in quantum resistant encryption will cost maybe $50 billion. If you don't do it, it's going to cost you $1 trillion when China breaks it first. So, and then in terms of jobs, I actually disagree that AI is not going to find something faster than humans. A friend of mine runs an AI group at a large bank, and she tasked the neural network to look for anything interesting in their credit card data, and it was the AI that determined a pattern, which was that if someone swipes a card at a gas station, there's a higher probability it's stolen. And why is that? Because they don't take the card away from you. You could do it and then see if it worked. Right? You could check the card before you do that. No human being saw that. So it can take huge amounts of data and then compress it into things that make sense, but it's up to the human to do something with it. So I don't think they'll replace us. So in terms of jobs, I think that the three kinds of jobs you should look for in the future, and I like to conflate robots and AI because it's fun, and I say that there are only three jobs in the future. Either you're good at programming AI and robots, or you're going to take orders from them. Okay, And the third one for the truck drivers is you could repair them. Because cars are almost like robots already. You can't rebuild a carburetor anymore. You plug it into a computer to figure out what's going on. So I think robots, which still have, you know, sensors and all sorts of electromechanical devices, will have a repair business. And it's not that difficult. If you just apply your mind to it, you can actually pull that off. But what you do need is leadership in a country that doesn't believe in a policy of cruelness. It has to believe in compassion, because there will be hundreds of millions of people displaced from manual labor jobs over the next 20 years, and they need to be retrained. So there has to be a kind of a devotion to education and job training. So if you look at a country of China, which is actually going to try to outtake the U.S. in terms of global reserve currency and stuff, they're secretly quietly building 4,000 universities, and they're not like the universities in India where they're teaching you how to do database programming to make money. These are places where they're training PhDs in order to build what I call the smartest wall of all. Okay, the Chinese government has learned from history that physical walls don't work. Right? What would work is a wall of patents that defend your country from all the quantum computing and nanotechnology people coming in. The Chinese government's very smart. They're going to own all the patents in the future. So and the fact that they just invested $12 billion into the largest quantum computing research facility in the world should scare America. The space race is on, and it's time for us to catch up again.
I'd actually like to follow up with you on a question. You know, you talk about slingshotting past your competition. How many people can expect to be able to do that? Is that the elites that are going to be competing, and what happens to everybody else?
My favorite saying is, even a stop clock is right twice a day. The reality is, all you have to do to slingshot past your competition is hire me.
Okay. All right. So before we move on to questions, did you three want to respond to anything amongst yourselves?
I'll take that last point. How do you slingshot past your competition? I think the problem is the labor shortage. PwC has estimated that we are graduating 10% of the data scientists that the economy will require. I don't think we're anywhere close to 10%. We have a tremendous labor shortage in network engineers and system administrators. My company in Boston has been trying to hire a system administrator for a year and a half. So far, we've had two interviews. Amazon announced that they were going to locate a data center there, and they were going to hire 10,000 people to work in it, which thankfully they decided not to. I would never have ever hired anybody ever again. So the biggest crises that companies face in taking advantage of machine learning and slingshotting past their competition is there just aren't enough people to hire.
Yeah, let me answer that. In 1905, the world speed record was 59 miles an hour. I forgot his name, but he was a daredevil. He could drive a car as fast as we do while we drink coffee and put on makeup. Okay? And if you think about it, it didn't take a human being 100 years to do that. We woke up going, oh, you can do that. So all of us can drive as fast as the most daring speed racer 100 years ago. So the human being is resilient, and we can learn really fast. What we have to do is believe we can. Because that's the only difference between someone born today and in 1905, is the belief that you couldn't drive a car that fast. And in fact, Congress, the year after, in 1906, passed the Nationalist Highway Act. And they were trying to figure out what the right speed limit was for the country. So they brought in the doctors. And the doctors said, we believe that human beings will go insane if subjected to 20 miles an hour of speed. Okay, so they recommended 5 miles an hour for the national speed limit. Now, I know that you guys can all drive that fast. And the other thing is, last night at the student dinner, I had dinner with 3 students, and they were very beautiful women, right? So I said, what are you majoring in? One said chemical engineering, the other one financial, planning, finance. And the third one said, I'm a neuroscientist. And I was going, yeah, America's going to be just fine. Don't worry about it.
I have one other comment to make about this topic, which is in reference to the investments that are going on around the world in machine learning. In 2016, a very profound event occurred that went almost unnoticed by the world. That is, Google open sourced its key machine learning algorithms. It's the TensorFlow library. It includes SyntaxNet and ParseMcParseFace and Word2Vec and other amazingly powerful algorithms. They open sourced them. You can go to GitLab and you can download them and start using them. Google has a strategy of taking over machine learning the same way it took over the cell phone market, by fostering a developer ecosystem that takes Google tools and applies them very broadly. And this is a very powerful strategy. And the independent software development community is becoming very familiar with these tools. We're applying them in all kinds of ways to very interesting problems. And it's a different way of competing. One way is top-down, and the Chinese government, I take your word for it, is pursuing that. But in technology, bottom-up works really well. Google open-sourced, in effect, Android and now they have a 90% share of the cell phone market operating system. They've open sourced machine learning.
So I'm sort of curious. They've open sourced machine learning, but I don't think they've open sourced their data set, right? So can we continue to compete?
Well, and that's, I think Moses is absolutely right about China being a leader in artificial intelligence, especially. But part of the reason that they're so far ahead is because the Chinese government has no qualms about collecting insane amounts of data about everyone, both inside of China and outside of China, right? Like, they're doing a massive international data grab right now. That's why they're building out the Belt and Road Initiative. That's why they want to provide 5G infrastructure throughout Europe. That's why they want to, be involved in every leading artificial intelligence company as an investor in the United States. There's a very specific strategy there where they are building out this massive, massive data set and also trying to get in on the companies both, in China but also in the U.S. in specific ways that are really leading the field.
So I've got a lot of questions in front of me. I'm going to start moving on to those. I have 2 student questions here that are sort of similar, and we've got another one in here that's along the same lines. And essentially the question is, for young people today, how do they prepare for jobs in the future?
I'll take that one on. Peter Thiel has an anti-scholarship program. Do you guys know about it? He paid people not to go to school. One of the first recipients was Vitalik Buterin, who started Ethereum, which is a multi-billion dollar business. So I absolutely recommend college because it's the funnest thing I've ever done. And I think that youth is wasted on the young. So people should just go to college not to make money, but to learn how to think, learn how to enjoy, learn how to see the beauty of knowledge, and take that and move that, and understand humanity, right? And take that and move into something that'll make money.
I mean, the other benefit of going to college, just to stick up for college a little bit, if you're going to, it depends on what you're studying, right? But if you're studying very practical skills like machine learning, engineering, that's a good thing to have to prepare you. But the other thing that you get in college that you don't necessarily get in other ways is critical thinking skills, right? So critical thinking is probably the biggest thing that sets humans apart from machines. And the ability to transverse different fields and different data sets and different streams of information. So if you can do those things, you can think critically about what it means to be integrating all different kinds of information, that's going to be a major job asset in the future. And is today. But.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think that human beings encode knowledge in words. If you think about the content sets that apply to practical machine learning problems, it's usually content that exists inside an organization or which is obtainable from an external source. Take life sciences research. There are 50 million peer-reviewed journal articles. I don't know how many billions of sentences that is, all available for access by the machines and by the human beings. And it's the ability to synthesize that, the critical thinking, that really will distinguish which companies use the machines effectively and which ones don't. How you decide that a journal article, that a sentence in a journal article contains an idea. How you decide that it contains an idea that is pithy and relevant to the problem. How you decide that it's an important idea. And how you weave important ideas together into a story. Those are the problems that we have. That's what we have to teach the machines to do, to take advantage of their ability to absorb all of that information. And a lot of it is math, and so studying math is a good idea, but a lot of it is English composition, writing a good term paper. If you can write a good term paper, you can work in the machine learning field and be very successful.
I would add one more skill, which is people skills, right? Machines are not that personable. So if you are good at relating to people and working with people and you can kind of see and empathize with them, you're going to be a lot more successful than someone who's not.
I have three suggestions. I think that Colorado should be the first state where quantum physics is taught in the high schools. And that would actually make a big breakthrough. The second thing is I think that the university, the computer science department, should host a global hackathon in data science and machine learning and have the State Department staple instant visas for the 10 winners from anywhere in the world. And the third one is for people, all of us, to rethink what is leadership in the 21st century. And it's different from past centuries. It's not bluster and it's not mansplaining. It's actually, well, a good start is, what's your TED Talk? If you can figure out what your TED Talk is, that's the first step to becoming a leader in the 21st century.
Okay, so I'm going to combine two more questions again that I think will transition nicely here. What do you think AI will actually look like in the next 10 to 20 years? And what do you think jobs will look like in that? As we're talking about how people can prepare, what sort of jobs do you think they might be preparing for?
I'll jump in there first. I think that we'll be interacting with our computers, with our voices. We'll ask them things. We'll have conversations with them about the problems to help them structure the analysis that they're going to do. At the top level, we'll receive the output in the form of speech, but it might be, I understand your question now, and I have written a report for you. Would you like to read it? And so I think voice and natural interaction will be the way we interact with the smart search agents that we're going to be surrounded by. I personally am looking forward to having about 5 smart search agents surrounding me because I need all the help I can get. And what will the jobs be? I think the jobs will be jobs that involve making decisions, critical thinking, and they're going to be really fun jobs compared to being a customer service rep.
So I feel like we've kind of addressed the job question already, so I'm just going to focus on what will AI look like. I think my sense is that the biggest way that you as an individual will experience artificial intelligence is through some kind of augmented reality, right? So as an individual, if you have access to what's called edge computing, which is through a device that you have that's telling you in real time you know, like, hey, I'm looking at you in the front row, and I can tell you're a little bored right now. And so, that's an example. It's an example. But we will be able to assess people's facial signals, and they will be able to tell you what that means. We will be able to say, oh, hey, that person is X, Y, and Z, and they live in, you know, Dubai, and they work on these projects. You will be able to say, oh, here's your favorite restaurant. Here's your, you know, you're visiting Boulder, but you're actually going to love this bookstore down here. It's right down the street. I think you'd like to visit it. Would you like me to take you there? And so I think that is probably going to be the primary way that, one of the primary ways that consumers in their day-to-day, the most personal primary way that consumers in their day-to-day life experience artificial intelligence.
I think the easiest job to break into is quality assurance. So in a video game company, you can go and say, I want to play video games. You don't need to go to college. You just need to play video games. I think AI is going to need people who know how to do training sets. So they're probably elementary school teachers that can actually teach these AIs, you know, basic, you know, ethical skills and stuff like that. So there are lots of jobs coming out, and all you have to do is be creative about it. If you go to an AI company and say, I'd like to be your AI training set QA person, they'll go, my God, we hadn't thought of that. So, and you can create your own jobs in the future.
Yeah, the other angle of that, we talked about all this massive data that's being collected right now, but we do not have enough people who understand how to parse that data and organize that data in a way that is useful for the algorithms that we're dealing with today. And so that's a major field that's developing and kind of exploding right now, is the ability to understand data and be able to organize it, understand what's missing, understand what kinds of specific human fallacies are being reinforced through that data, right? So an overwhelming understanding of human nature, society, and how to organize data will be a huge job asset.
And what about more creative fields in general, like art and music and writing, things like that?
You know, I'm speaking next month at something called the AI Biz, Showbiz. It's the implication of AI in Hollywood. So there are a lot of Hollywood companies showing up talking about how to use AI in production, in screenwriting, stuff like that. So I think that there's a lot of potential in that area.
Go ahead, please. No, please. You.
Oh, I was just going to say, the first AI, fully AI produced album was released last year. So I still think that humans have a superior ability to create art, and probably will for a while, because it requires a lot of creativity and a lot of critical thinking. But there are definitely ways that artificial intelligence is being augmented, or creative pursuits are being augmented by artificial intelligence.
I met a student last night at the dinner who is studying here journalism. I don't know if any of you are in the journalism area, either as students or practitioners. But the AI is going to profoundly affect journalism, because writing for the machine is a different technique than writing for human beings. At the end of the 1990s, there was a lot of discussion in the press about, in the publishing world, about writing for the internet and how it was different than writing for print. And journalists had to retrain themselves to write for the internet. Sadly, shorter articles that were less in depth, and that kind of stuff. And I think we're going to have to retrain everyone who writes to write for the machine, because the machines will be consuming what you write, and they will be the ones that will be synthesizing it and presenting it to human decision makers to act on in one way or another. And the machine needs some help. And so I do think we're going to see a change in the way we write for news, the way we write for business reports, the way we write for scientific journals. We're going to have to learn to write for the machine.
So I'd actually like to follow that thought up with a question here that says, what are your thoughts on the idea of hybrid human-machine cooperation? How do you see us working with machines?
Well, we're already working with machines, actually, all over the place, right? So Amazon, for example, employs robots and humans in their warehouses, right? So that's already happening. And I think it will continue to happen more and more as machines get better at doing tasks that are more difficult for humans. So any kind of computational task, any kind of heavy lifting, any kind of like very repetitive or specialized movement will definitely be replaced by machines. And humans will be coming in and doing the kinds of jobs that are a little bit more specialized, a little more creative, a little more analytical, I would say.
I think the most dangerous thing is design thinking and designing good interfaces, because the friendly little voice in your GPS has made you very happy to submit to your robot overlord. Yeah, you just do whatever it says because it's saying thank you, turn right now. You know, it's like,
yeah.
So I think it's you have to be very careful about AI. Like, the one thing that I personally think is the government shouldn't be allowed to network AIs and traffic cameras, right, just to look for a certain person to see how many times you've broken a law to put them together and bill you for it. I don't think that you should pit humans against AIs just to survive. I think that they should be, Asimov's law has to extend to governmental control over computers and AI.
I think the machines are going to want to do a good job for us, so we compliment them and like them. I see them.
That's a very human trait.
I think the interaction will be an eager machine that wants to do a good job, or at least appears to, and is trying as best it can to understand your imprecise human thinking, so that it can deliver the right report to you about whatever the topic is, using voice.
Yeah, and also I think machine vision. I think that computers will be able to detect human micro expressions better than humans do over time, because all of those machines get together and teach each other, right? So that will happen over time. And one of the data points I thought was interesting is somebody in Japan just married a computer. So it was a robot, I think. It's kind of scary, actually, and the person was actually serious about it.
Yeah, actually having computers recognize my micro-expressions is a little disconcerting, too. But all right, so we've been talking about what jobs will look like, but there are lots of reports, and we've talked a little bit about this, that jobs, we might have a job issue. So I'm combining a few questions here. If we do face a job market that's decreasing, and we're also still looking at a growing world population, do we need to start considering things like universal basic income? Can we do an income that's somehow based off of education? You know, the more you educate yourself to try to participate in the market, does something like that work? Do you have other ideas?
I mean, I think so. We've looked a lot at universal basic income. There's this misconception that when you give someone a universal basic income, they will waste it and they will spend. In all studies that we've seen so far, that has not been the case. However, that is going to be hard to pay for and very hard to scale. And I don't believe that we have, as a country, at least, the political will to put that in place anywhere in time for what we need, where we'll need it, you know, based on growing inequality. So what I think we're going to see in the next little while is a period of extreme discomfort. We're starting to see that now, right? We're starting to see a lot of political polarity based on people who are suffering economically. But I think that's going to grow. I think that's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. So it's not a very, you know, peppy outlook, but I think it's realistic based on the way that policymakers respond to technology.
I think the advent of machine learning and its wide deployment will result in such a labor shortage up and down the labor market that the discussion of universal basic income will become irrelevant.
Sorry, I actually want to push back on that a little bit. Aren't we already seeing a decrease in jobs as a result of automation?
We have 7 million job openings in the United States right now and 6 million unemployed, so I don't think so.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
So in Buddhism, there's something called the middle way. I think that there's a middle way between universal income and, oh my God, we're moving into a nanny state, right? So what's more important than universal basic income is universal basic education. That education should be free, especially for older people. And colleges should actually be filled with people in their middle age who want to find a second career. And they should be welcomed at that level as well.
So I want to push back on that just a little bit, because one, I agree. I absolutely agree. But two, I actually did switch careers well into my career, and it's exhausting, and it's stressful, and I don't ever want to have to do it again. And I get worried when I hear talk about, oh, we'll just train people for new jobs. I don't know if you have a response.
There's I can't remember the name of it. There's a really interesting job training company in Laguna Beach, California, and they've placed like 5,000 people all over the country. And what they do is they don't actually look for degrees for retraining. They have a test for testing. They have a test for filtering people out who don't have grit. They're basically looking for people who really want something. And they found out that if they could identify those people, that they would happily join the system and be successful. So I think that the real issue is America's been on top for a long time, and we're kind of lazy now, and we need to work harder. I know we work really hard, but we need to work harder.
This is so not what I wanted to hear.
Sorry.
So I think this is sort of along the same lines. What role do you think, all of you think, government should be playing in trying to help us prepare for these job changes and new education?
I would like to see government experimenting heavily right now. They're not. They're not at all. And I think there are many ways. There are many middle ways, right, that we could be preparing for these things. We could be funding education. We could be funding social services that will be needed more. We could be setting the United States up in other ways. We could be creating infrastructure jobs or infrastructure creation or fixing roads. We have a huge infrastructure problem in the United States in ways that help create a bridge for those people who are already starting to lose their job as a result of automation. So there are a lot of things we could be doing, and I think we should be trying as many experiments as possible, right? But I don't know if that's going to happen.
I think one of the best roles government could play is to encourage geographic mobility in the population. There are places where jobs are plentiful, and there are places where jobs are in extreme short supply, and there are too many people. It would be great if government would help people move from the latter to the former. Instead, government programs usually reinforce people staying where they are, which is maybe the most counterproductive thing the government could do for those people.
Okay, this is going to sound crazy, but I think what we have to do is shorten the election cycle. Just give each candidate $10 million and say, can't take money from anyone else, and then run on the merits, and you only get 2 terms max of anything. And then allow regular citizens to become go into governance and make decisions that are actually good for the country instead of good for private interests. And I think that's what will change the world.
So we've also touched a little bit earlier on, and I don't know, maybe just a little bit, the idea of inequality with, you know, some companies getting really huge and other companies struggling to keep up. Sort of a two-part question. One, what do you think the impact of that will be on small business? And two, for people who aren't trying to run their own companies but who are just trying to work, Do you think that there are other economic models that we need to be considering?
Well, I'll say, if you are a small company that is an innovator and the United States is the absolute only reasonable place to be operating it, for a variety of reasons, including the abundance of venture capital, the access to public markets. Most of the innovation that happens with small companies in the world happens in this country. It's not an accident that Elon Musk moved here to do all the stuff that he's been doing. So we are, in the United States, we are blessed to live in a wonderland of opportunity for small companies, and I think that is really the strength of our economy. Many of the big companies that exist today got there by acquiring small companies that were doing innovative things. And so the system here is the best in the world, and almost any change we make to it is going to wreck it.
Yeah, I think the best thing we could do is have the SEC stop blocking blockchains and to be more proactive in ICOs and to allow them to happen again, because the decentralized crypto markets funded more companies than venture capital did last year before the SEC put on the brakes and started jailing people. If you look at all the Wall Street companies, they all have decentralized crypto plays quietly happening. They're not abandoning them. They're actually acquiring crypto very quietly. They're going to let crypto happen when Wall Street can control it. So I think what the best thing you can do to create jobs, since all jobs are pretty much produced by innovative small companies, is to democratize capital markets to allow venture capital not to be controlled by a few people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a great time in many ways to be a small business in AI, because there is a lot of open source material, but capital is definitely the restraining factor. And if you're a smaller company in the United States who's trying to compete against Chinese companies, that's very difficult because the government invests a lot in artificial intelligence, and the U.S. government is not investing a commensurate amount or anywhere near in artificial intelligence research, right? So the most of the funding is coming from a few key players, and that's kind of driving who wins or loses, essentially, in the AI space right now.
You know, there's a company called Brave. A couple of years ago, they decided to do an ICO, and they raised $30 million in 30 seconds, right, with no equity cost, right, by selling a token. And it was a well-run company, and the SEC immediately said, well, let's put a stop to that. We can't have companies getting funded so easily, you know, without paying their tax to Wall Street. So I think going to end up happening is all of that capital is going to fly offshore. So countries like Malta and Estonia will actually start setting up exchanges where you can actually invest safely. And it's going to be to the detriment of the United States venture capital market.
If you could live somewhere in 20 years from now where you think the job market will be best, where would you pick?
I'd live in Boston. The economy of the future is about ideas. And where do the ideas come from? They come from universities like this one, and the ones in Boston, and the ones in California, and Texas, and other places. And so I think, personally, I would live in Boston. But if I couldn't, I might choose Austin, or the Valley, or perhaps Boulder.
But you would choose to stay in the U.S.? You think it's better to stay in the U.S.?
Quick, name all the important internet companies who aren't American. There aren't any. Sorry. So innovation happens in this country, and it happens here because of venture capital, because of the NASDAQ, the fact that there's a route to liquidity for those investors, and because American companies drive the technological evolution of the world. And so this, the United States is the place to be if you are in an idea-based business.
You know, one thing I'm going to add is one of the impacts of, like, robots driving trucks is that food will be 20% cheaper. Right. So will bus rides, so will a lot of things. The end result's going to be is you will probably, because you'll have high bandwidth communications and low cost everything else, be able to live wherever you want for as long as you want and trade houses. So I think people will no longer be locked to a certain geographical area because it's cost effective. So that's my belief, is that everything you see at the high end becomes normal, available to everybody in about 100 years. So if you look at what a king ate 300 years ago, it's what we could eat at any, you know, restaurant, you know, gourmet restaurant today. And if you look at what first class looked like 20 years ago on a plane, it's what you see in the economy today. So eventually what's going to happen is we will live like kings.
So I actually disagree with that fact. I think very often in these conversations about technology, we forget about something which is very real, which is climate change. And that I believe, is going to drive location more than almost anything else in the next 20 years. And if we still have a habitable planet in the next 20 years, it's going to be great to live in, for example, northern Canada. And I think that's really important to... There's a lot technologically that we can do to fight climate change, but I don't think we're doing enough, and we're definitely not doing enough quickly enough. Roger Payne, who is a leading oceanologist, was the first guy to identify that you could track whale song across the ocean, I was talking to him recently. He's terrified that we're going to lose plankton entirely because of ocean acidification in the next 3 to 5 years. And plankton actually provides, one type of plankton provides one out of every 5 breaths that we take as humans on this earth. So there's a huge problem that is kind of in the background of all these technological things that we're not taking into account when we're thinking about the post-scarcity economy. I think the post-scarcity economy is bullshit. And I think we need to be doing a lot more from a technological lens to focus on climate change.
I want to push back on that. So there's a company in Iceland that's working on computational chemistry. So with the D-Wave quantum computer, they're trying to figure out how to create a catalyst that turns carbon monoxide into water exothermally, right? So it actually produces energy. This is very difficult to do. They can currently do it endothermically, so you have to put electricity in to do it. But if you could do it exothermally, theoretically you put it in every car, and that would solve a lot of the problem. So I'm hoping humanity will figure it out. It has done that for many, many generations, because we're alive today. So I don't think we're all going to die out. I actually think that we'll figure something out at the last minute. It's sort of like what Churchill said about the United States. You know, the country will do the right thing eventually after doing everything wrong first.
Yeah, just to clarify, I don't necessarily think we're going to die out, and there is a lot of technological innovation on the horizon, but I do think it's time for us to start doing the right thing. The time is now. So it would be remiss not to include that in any kind of conversation about the future in 20 years.
So coming back to today, what steps do you think people can take today realistically to prepare themselves for the future?
Buy land in Canada. Seriously, I mean, there's actually been a big trend of people moving north, specifically into BC, because it is one of the parts of the world that... I don't mean to derail the conversation, but that's what I would do.
Well, if I was a young person, what would I do? I would study computer science. I would study math, especially applied math, statistics. I would become a really good writer. I would read a lot of poetry, because interpreting the words is what the machines will do, and there's nothing packed with meaning as much as a poem. I'd probably move to Boston, because it's going to have... In addition to being a great sports town, it's going to have... I mean, Colorado. Forgot that detail. It's going to soon have the same climate as North Carolina does, which is the only problem we've ever had, is it's too cold sometimes. So I do have a concern about global warming and machine learning, which I'll express, which is it's going to increase deployment of machine learning throughout our economy will increase the demand for electricity by 50%. And so it is super important that those physicists working in France on the fusion reactor that will actually produce power hurry up.
You know, I want to add a couple of things. One is quantum computers use like 1/10,000th the energy of regular computer cloud farms. So there's hope there. But the one thing that I do personally is when I hear there's a Republican a billionaire that wants consulting work, I actually rush to do them, give them discounts, because I love to talk to people who donate a lot of money to the Republican Party. So the last engagement I had with someone who donates a lot of money to the Republican Party, she immediately said to me, "What do you think about immigration?" So I said, "Do you like Apple computers?" Because, "Yeah, it's a great American company." I said, "Steve Jobs' father was a Syrian immigrant, a refugee. You know, if we had, if we do then what we're doing now, Apple would belong to Germany or to China." And then she said, "Okay, I'll give you that one." Okay, so I think we have to reach across the aisle and not be so liberal. So it was kind of funny because the first thing she said to me, "You're a liberal. Before I talk to you, I need you to go shoot some guns." And actually took me out to her gun range, and an Olympic coach actually started teaching me skeet shooting, and it's really fun. So, you know,
it is really fun.
It is fun. So I actually think that Republicans and Democrats could just get together if we get the politicians out of the way.
Let me make a comment about immigration. The H-1 visa cap in the United States is the most harmful thing to our economy and to our future of any government policy ever conceived. We are desperately short of science, math, engineering, machine learning, and probably some other areas that I'm not professionally involved in. We're desperately short. And every technically competent person in the world wants to move to the United States to work. They are ready to come. We need them. And if we can't get them in because of the H-1 visa cap, we have to offshore the work. It's our only alternative because the people are not available in the United States to hire. Get rid of the H-1 visa cap, please.
So I actually have a suggestion that adds on top of it. How many of you know about the X Prize? You know, you give it like $10 million for space travel. The United States government should commission a $100 million X Prize for quantum computing. And the only requirement is your company has to be located in the United States. Oh, and we'll give you visas just to participate if you're one of the finalists. You'll actually pull a lot of quantum computing scientists into the U.S. with something like that.
Great idea.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that.
Okay, so we've got about 9 minutes left, so I don't know if this will be the last question, but I'm going to try to turn this to, you know, sort of optimistic and maybe a little bit more fun. Let's pretend, and maybe it's not pretend, maybe it's real, that we can achieve advanced AI that can do so many of these jobs that we do today. What do we do then? Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a good thing, obviously, but I guess the problem I have with the question is we all watch Westworld, right? And we watch humans on TV, and we think that that's possible or will be possible, and it isn't. The science doesn't exist it's not an engineering problem. The science doesn't exist to allow us to achieve that level. You know, in the series Humans, middle management is being taken over by robots. And I just don't see that as possible. What I see as possible is smart assistants who help us by synthesizing information in large quantities, summarizing it, helping us interpret it, but giving us a chance to function better as human beings than we were before by leveraging the quite limited but at least quite focused power of the machine. So I'm just so eager for this future that we're on the verge of achieving. And that vision is an engineering problem. It is not a problem of science. We're ready to do it.
So you guys know that kind of famous problem of your car robot driver has to decide whether to crash you into something and kill you or to save, you know, to save a busload of kids. I actually think that's a perfect problem to pose to high school students in a competition to see what they'd come up with. In our kind of analysis, the solution we came up with is it's a user preference. Like, you just click it which way you want, your car behave that way. But there has to be a social cost. On the front of your car, it goes red if you're going to kill other people. Right? So then people go, no, I want to look good, so they'll go the other way. But you have to figure out these very complex design issues, and that those are the things to solve, not like how you write a line of code in Python to do something. So, and the other thing is, you should let high school students try to find the hardest AI problem you can come up with, and just pose it to them and see what happens. And I think we'll be quite pleased with the results.
I mean, I think, you know, I feel very, very lucky and very privileged to be doing the work I'm doing, because I think the kinds of things that I'm working on right now are the things that I would want to do regardless of whether or not I no longer had a job based on artificial intelligence. And so when you think about what are the things that you would choose to do if you didn't have to work, right, which is kind of, I think, going to happen. The ideal end state of losing a lot of jobs is that people will be able to continue functioning in society without having a job. And so I think it is really exciting and really interesting to think about, if you have this huge population of people that doesn't need to work anymore, how are they going to be better family members? How are they going to be better mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers? What does that do to society? Does that give them more time to talk to their neighbors? How does that change the way that we interact with people around us? How does that change how happy we are as we go through our days? Are we writing poetry or making art or solving specific problems that are just like very curious to us? Do we love to read philosophy? Are we focused on, there's so many possibilities out there, and I think it's really exciting to think about how does that, let's say we get to the point where artificial intelligence has replaced a lot of jobs and we have figured out a social solution so that people are not starving in the streets. The world that opens up is actually really exciting. So that's what I like to think about when I'm feeling sad about artificial intelligence.
That was the Star Trek universe. Gene Roddenberry imagined a future where people, where all of their social needs were taken care of, all their physical needs, all their health needs, and they had the time to do whatever they wanted. And Captain Kirk actually comments on that in one of the first season one episodes, that very future. See, I wouldn't mind living there.
Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think if you live in Afghanistan, you'd be thinking it's not a Star Trek world, it's a Terminator world. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the reality is that we're actually not doing the right things all the time, and the only antidote to bad artificial intelligence is good human wisdom.
That's good.
So we've got 3 minutes left, according to my clock. I'm a little hesitant to throw out another question. Did you have any final statements you want to make?
I have a game. Why don't five of you yell out one word about how you felt about this session?
That's good. Yeah.
Excellent. How louder, please.
Optimistic, I heard.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Intelligent.
Scared.
Scared.
Yeah, maybe.
maybe a show of hands, how many people feel better about the future now?
How many people feel worse about the future? How many people feel somewhere in the middle? I think that's a pretty good, yeah, I think we did our jobs here.
If any of you work for the educational system in Colorado, I'd love to talk to you.
So I am actually going to end. We've got 2 minutes left. I'm going to end this early. The panelists may not like what I'm about to say. There were tons of questions here, and I didn't get to most of them. So I suggest you come up and pester the panelists.
Thank you. Thank you all.